Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a photojournalist who witnessed and documented Afghanistan during and after the Taliban, the Iraq War, where her reporting demonstrated the swiftness and completeness of the invasion, but the failure to adequately plan for the occupation and transition. And she was among the first photojournalists to witness the pogroms and atrocities in Darfur and the culture of violence against women in the Congo. But nothing prepared Lindsay Addario for her capture and imprisonment during the Libyan Civil War during the Arab Spring of 2011. Then she and three of her New York Times colleagues, reporter Stephen Farrell, the late Anthony Shadid, as well as fellow photojournalist Tyler Hicks, were covering a motley group of Libyan rebels when their area came under attack by a militia loyal to Gaddafi. They were captured and for the next 5 days were held where they were repeatedly beaten, and also in the case of Addario, sexually groped repeatedly. Addario has written an account of that incident, her work in nearly every major theater of war in this century, as well as her journey and passion to become one of the top photojournalists in the country in her book, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. It's published by Penguin. Addario's work appears regularly in the New York Times, the National Geographic, and Time magazine. She received numerous awards, including the MacArthur Genius Grant, as well as being a part of the Pulitzer Prize in 2009 in international reporting for the New York Times coverage in Waziristan. Lindsay Addario is my guest today. Lindsay Addario, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Rich. Thank you for having me.
As a photojournalist, you've been in some hairy positions, but certainly none worse than what you begin your book with. In March 2011, you decided to go to Libya.
I did. I was covering the popular uprising for the New York Times, and it was sort of at the height of the Arab Spring. Tunisia and Egypt had already happened, and I went briefly to Bahrain when the uprising in Libya started, and I raised my hand and asked the New York Times if I could go. And I went and was covering the front line. We didn't really anticipate there being heavy fighting. So many of the journalists who went into Libya assumed it would be much like Egypt, where there was a popular uprising and then perhaps the leader would be overthrown. And in the case of Libya, that did not happen. And there was very heavy combat. So I was covering the front line with my colleagues. And about 2 weeks into that, we ran into a checkpoint of Gaddafi soldiers, and we were taken hostage for a week.
And you've been in a lot of close shaves over probably a decade of working as a foreign photojournalist in a lot of hot zones, but this was by far the worst.
It was, because it went on for a week, and it was in that week we had no idea if we would survive. I mean, over the course of 6 or 7 days, we were tied up and blindfolded and beaten up and repeatedly threatened with execution. The first 3 days were the worst, and then once we were flown to Tripoli in a military aircraft, that was also a very violent transfer. And when we arrived in Tripoli, we were handed over to a group of men that we were told were with the foreign ministry. And from that point on, we were not beaten anymore, but we were still held captive. And we were so terrified at that point. We had really been sort of beaten into submission and really traumatized by that point. So just being held captive was terrifying, because we just didn't know if or when we would be released.
Now, you were with a very experienced journalist and photojournalist, Anthony Shadid, the late Anthony Shadid, Tyler Hicks, Stephen Farrell, these gentlemen that were with you. You had been detained occasions before. What was different about this particular time?
Well, every time is different. I mean, all of us had very extensive experience working in frontline zones and combat zones, as you said, and you know, that, I think, really worked to our advantage, because we all knew from the minute we were taken not to fight back and to be very submissive and to do whatever we were told to do. And I think that really worked in our favor. Every experience is very different, because your captors are different. And in the case of Libya, each time we changed hands, each time we were handed over to a different group of men, they beat us once again. They threatened us with death. Some people would rise up and show signs of being nice to us, and meanwhile other people were just evil and horrible with us.
Really, the thing that saved you was basically, there was a tug of war between whether it was the Interior Ministry, which would have been bad news, and the Foreign Ministry, which would end up with you.
Well, that's what Anthony was able to translate for us. I mean, when we were transferred to Tripoli on a military aircraft, and we were, it was very violent. We were sort of tied to the walls of the plane. We were tied with zip ties, and we were beaten very extensively on the tarmac when we landed in Tripoli. And there was a moment in which they put us in a paddy wagon, and then they pulled us out and put us in an SUV vehicle. And suddenly a man spoke English to us in a very gentle voice and said, "We will not beat you anymore. You're now with the government of Libya." But before that, clearly we were not with people who were trying to calm us down and say that they would be respectful to us. And Anthony had overheard on the tarmac that there was this struggle going on between the Ministry of Interior and the Foreign Ministry.
I would assume the Interior Ministry would be like the security apparatus of the
government.
Yeah, I
mean, I think in so many of these countries, the Interior Ministry is synonymous with torture. And we, in fact, when we were taken captive and before we were taken captive, one of our colleagues, Gaith Abdulhad, he was working for The Guardian, and he had been taken, and we heard that he was being tortured. And he was with the Ministry of Interior, and it was sort of always in many of these countries that we had worked in, the Interior Ministry was really equivalent of a ministry that believed in torture.
Well, of the forces that took you, was it part of the Libyan army, or was it more like what we've come to see in Libya, which is the sort of warlords allied with Gaddafi, or what exactly?
Well, I mean, we, you know, obviously we can't say, because it's not like they identify themselves and say, "Hi, my name is, and I will be your captor." I mean, I think, you know, for us, it was, we believe there were forces loyal to Gaddafi. I think it was Gaddafi's military, but of course, you don't know, because it was an uprising. So people joined either side and sort of contributed their manpower to either side.
Yeah, and prior to being taken, you were watching what seemed to be, at the time, seemed to be a very idealistic look at the uprising in Libya, which was, you were watching doctors and physicians and engineers, guys who had never had a day of military training, all of a sudden taking arms up against their country.
Exactly, and that was what was exhilarating about it, because here were these people that had never been able to express themselves before because they lived under such a repressive regime, and suddenly they were out fighting for their freedom. And so it felt very important to be there documenting this momentous time in history, in Libya's history. And then suddenly it turned incredibly violent, and, you know, we were held at the hands of people loyal to Gaddafi. And Gaddafi had made many announcements throughout the course of the beginning of the uprising, saying, "Look, if you see foreign journalists in the East, they're all spies, they're all terrorists because they've come into the country illegally." None of us had visas to be in Libya at the time because it was an uprising. So, of course, Gaddafi did not want journalists covering the uprising. So the only authorized journalists were in Tripoli, and we had entered illegally through Egypt.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that came out, and this has probably been a trend that far predates Libya, but Libya and then Syria has changed the rules for covering uprisings and conflicts and civil wars, in which journalists are far more fair game in the conflict than they have ever been before. Did you notice a change in the rules, or has this been a long evolving situation?
Well, I think it's been evolving over time, and certainly now I would say is the most brutal time for journalists ever. I think it started in 2003, 2004 in Iraq, when journalists started getting kidnapped in Iraq. I myself was detained for a day outside of Fallujah in the village of Garma with another colleague for the New York Times. Unfortunately, we were released, but the day after we were released, I remember 30 foreigners were taken hostage all around Iraq. And so the trend certainly dated back to then, but over time it's become much more brutal in the sense that now journalists are held for ransom, we're a commodity, we've seen my colleagues beheaded on videos. I mean, it's horrendous. There's absolutely no respect for the sanctity of journalism and for the service that we provide.
Yeah. Well, take us back to what got you started down this path. Obviously, photography was something you had always done, and you had a chance to see a good part of the world from a young age.
I did, and I felt very lucky. I felt like with my camera, it was sort of a passport to go anywhere, and I could enter into people's lives and learn about different cultures and certainly document things that I felt were very important, like human rights issues, women's issues, humanitarian crises. And inevitably, a lot of those things happen on the margins of war. So suddenly, I was initially interested, for example, in covering women's issues under the Taliban and life under the Taliban for women. And I was living in India at the time, and in fact the Taliban was giving visas to journalists, so I didn't think it was so dangerous, because in fact if the Taliban is inviting journalists in, they will protect them because it's in their interest to make sure that foreign journalists are safe. So I went in and started covering women's issues under the Taliban, and then little by little, I found that many of the stories I was attracted to and that I felt were important to cover were stories that were happening on the margins of war and on the periphery of war and even in war zones. And so after September 11th, that just became exacerbated, and I ended up covering Afghanistan and then Iraq.
You tell the story of how you made that first trip. You'd been doing photography in the United States. You've been doing some foreign photography. Really, when you went to the Taliban-run Afghanistan, was that the first assignment really on the fringes of, well, there was a war zone at that particular time, but it was not, was that your first sort of, sort of face-to-face with a very repressive regime, which doesn't look at journalists particularly interesting, and more importantly, female journalists, it's even a second handicap?
Well, I think the first time I worked in a country where journalism was not a given right was in Cuba, because I started going to Cuba in 1997. So that was really the first time where I felt like I was being followed and that people were really monitoring what I was covering and that people were scared to have their picture taken or to speak freely because that could get them in trouble. And so that was very interesting, because that sort of introduced me to the notion of working in difficult conditions. And then in 2000, when I was living in India and I decided to go to Afghanistan, it was really the first time where I was working in a country that had been rife with war and that there were many people who had been landmine victims, and certainly there was no economy. I mean, the infrastructure of the entire country of Afghanistan had fallen apart, really. So when I went there, that was the case, and it was a fascinating place to work. Of course, there was no American embassy. There were no embassies functioning. So really, if anything had happened to me, the only people that I could rely on were people working with the United Nations, and there were divisions of the United Nations still working in Afghanistan at the time, and they were quite helpful to me. In terms of my gender, I think being a woman was incredibly useful, because I had access to women under the Taliban, which I never would have had I been a man.
True. You tell the story of getting a visa to visit Afghanistan. It involved, a fair number of trips to the visa office, and you actually befriended the visa clerk before he would actually process the visa.
Yeah, I mean, I basically planted myself in the visa office in Islamabad for the, it was sort of the Taliban embassy. So it was the Afghan embassy in Islamabad, and this was in 2000. And Kathy Gannon, who was the then Associated Press, I think she was the bureau chief at the time in Pakistan, she had many contacts in the embassy, and she sort of walked me in and said, you know, help this girl get a visa. But I had to go back every single day, and at first they wouldn't even look at me because I was sort of this single woman alone sitting in the embassy, and it was all men. And then eventually Muhammad, who was the visa clerk, started asking me questions, and then he would offer me tea. And I literally just went back every single day and started speaking with him. And eventually he sent my visa application, and we started having more and more in-depth conversations.
Yeah, finally he wanted to know what life was like in the West, and whether, you know, he wanted to know, is it permissible for a man and a woman to be together before they're married?
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating,
just
actually, because
to go on a date.
I mean, look, I was 26 years old, I think 26 or 27, and I, you know, I really was just engaging in a conversation as I would with anyone. Of course, I was very conscious of the fact that he was a representative of the Taliban, but at the end of the day, when you sit for 10 straight days with a young man and you start talking, I mean, we're all very similar, you know, so he was very curious, you know, is it true that men and women can be together without being married? And it was astonishing. I mean, I remember being completely taken aback by the question of, oh, my God, he's asking me these questions. I mean, he's a Talib.
My guest today is Lindsay Addario. She is a photojournalist, and her book is titled It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. It's published by Penguin. Has numerous photographs of her work, which are some amazing, amazing images, and include some of the worst war zones of the 21st century. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, earlier you said, you know, being female got you entree into the world of the Taliban women during the Taliban days, and it certainly has, it seems like it did open some doors at times, but, and I've heard from many female journalists who says, yes, it opens doors that, that sometimes in these parts of the world that men have more trouble because of the novelty of talking to a woman as a peer in official government circles. But where you are most of the time is on the street, and being a female photojournalist is a different lot in life. You had to learn very quickly in certain parts of the world, being female and alone, basically, opened you up to all sorts of minor to semi-major physical assault.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the case in Libya was very unique in the sense that we were covering an uprising. It was a very hostile time, and of course, we were the captives. And so I think, you know, we were subjected to being beaten, and I was subjected to sexual assault. And I think prior to that, I really hadn't, certainly, you know, in a demonstration, I would have men would touch my butt or, you know, minor things, but never as egregious or as rough as in Libya. So I do think that given the amount of time I've been covering these very delicate situations in places where women don't necessarily ever work, I've been pretty lucky.
Yeah. You spent time in Afghanistan and after 9/11, later in Iraq, and you have some amazing photographs of watching everything from the Taliban fall. Tell us about this warlord that you met. What is it? Aga.
Oh, Gulaga Shirzai.
Yeah. Sorry.
I mean, he was one of so many. I think anyone who's worked in Afghanistan, these guys are still around. I mean, there are guys who in the Civil War had played very big roles as warlords, and they were pretty vicious people. And then they learned to work with the Americans after September 11th, and they still have you know, their domain across parts of Afghanistan where they have power. Gulaga was the sort of self-appointed governor in Kandahar after the fall of the Taliban in Kandahar, and he was he took over the mansion, the governor's house, and all the journalists had sort of flooded in the day after Mullah Omar fled, and it was December 11th, I think, that was the day we went in, and I think there were other journalists who got in the day before, and the entire city was sort of just full of Afghan men. I don't remember even seeing Afghan women on the street for the first few days. And Gulaga Shirzai was working out of the governor's home, and he was quite a character. I mean, he reminded me of Fred Flintstone. He was sort of always entertaining and meeting with the journalists and very sort of had men from all the surrounding villages come. And then it was Ramadan, so during Eid, which was during the celebration following Ramadan, he would have these big meals, and when people would break their fast, he would invite people from the villages in to come and eat for free in his home. And so he was quite a character to follow around, and in fact, he's still around in Afghanistan. Yeah.
There's a great photo on the same page that you document him, and you tell the story of how you first met him, which is quite interesting because it gets into these prejudices of, I think you were working with an unnamed reporter who said, you know, you being a woman's going to, I'm not going to be able to get to my story, so we're on our own here. You're on your own there. But you have this great photograph on this page with Gulaga, and it is, again, a wonderful street scene where young Afghans are listening to music for the first time since the fall of the Taliban. That's an amazing, I mean, the photograph is great in its context, but you see them looking at the speakers and you say, what are they doing? And you just have to realize, only with a caption, you know, that this is like a major moment.
Yeah, I mean, when I say the first time, it wasn't, I couldn't say. Maybe they had listened a few hours before, but it was certainly the first few moments in which people were able to listen to music publicly in Afghanistan since the fall of the Taliban, because, you know, under the Taliban, any form of entertainment was banned. So there was no music, there was no TV. You can hear BBC radio, but there was no form of entertainment. So in those initial days after the fall of the Taliban, it was incredible because you would see scenes like that on the street. You know, you'd see these speakers and dozens and dozens of men would just gather around and listen to music. And, you know, Afghanistan is a place where I associate so much with Hindi music and music that comes out of India as I drive through these gorgeous, gorgeous landscapes of Afghanistan, because Afghans love Indian music and Bollywood music. And so it was so cool to see that scene. And, of course, I think some of those men gathered around just because there was a female photographer as well. You know, I think that's also important to point out because, you know, they also hadn't seen women's faces.
Right, indeed. My guest today is Lindsay Addario, a photojournalist. Her book is titled, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. It's published by Penguin, and it documents her time over a decade photographing and reporting from some of the most horrific conflicts in the 21st century, Afghanistan, Iran, Lebanon, Darfur, and the Congo. Darfur must have been a tough story, and you had some beautiful, beautiful photographs and heart-wrenching photographs from Darfur. How did that assignment come about?
Darfur was incredibly tough, primarily because of access. In 2004, Somini Sengupta, who was working for the New York Times, sent me an email, and we had loosely talked about trying to cover Darfur when we were working together in Iraq, and she sent me an email and said, okay, how do you feel about going in August? And we flew into Chad. It was impossible to get a visa for Sudan at the time to get into Darfur. Darfur is part of Sudan. And so we had to fly into neighboring Chad and walk into Darfur and meet up with a group of rebels and actually just drive around the desert and try and photograph these villages that had been bombed and burned out, meet up with civilians who were fleeing for their lives to neighboring Chad. It was incredible. There were skeletons littering the desert. It was a very difficult scene because, first of all, the conditions were completely unforgiving. It was the summer in the desert in Darfur. There were people, thousands and thousands of refugees who had fled to Chad. We ran out of water on, I think, the second day that we were there and had to find a well. We ended up finding a Save the Children well that had about 2 feet of water left in it. I mean, it was just this incredible scene. And what was so important about that story is that there really were not many journalists covering Darfur at the time because it was so hard to get in. And so any information that we can get and document from there was so important for the rest of the world to understand what was happening.
I want to ask you about the impact of your work. Darfur was one where journalists were, you know, it's hard to get there if you were caught up when a raid was coming from the Sudan. I mean, you know, all bets were off, really, even as a journalist. And yet, you know, journalists are putting these stories out, people like you putting photographs out, and yet not much really changed.
I don't know if not much changed, because there was huge international pressure on Sudan to deal with the situation.
I guess maybe the best thing were to say it took an awful long time.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, but I think, you know, in retrospect, an awful long time is what, 2009? That's about 5 years. If you're looking at some of these conflicts that go on for decades, you know, 5-6 years is not that long. Of course, it's extraordinarily long for the Sudanese and the people of Darfur who had to live in those conditions, and it's still going on. There's still thousands of people displaced from their villages and their homes, and the situation in South Sudan is horrible. So I think a lot of this is still going on, but I do think that international pressure does make a difference and does force governments to deal with what's happening in their country and to answer for war crimes.
Prior to your capture in Libya, perhaps the toughest assignment for you was when you were in Iraq in 2007. Is it the Korangal Valley?
Oh, Afghanistan in 2007.
Afghanistan. And some amazing photographs from that time, but that was a tough assignment.
That was an incredibly difficult assignment. I think I was working with Elizabeth Rubin for the New York Times Magazine, and we went in early September and flew out to the Korangal Valley, which was arguably one of the most dangerous places in the country at the time. We really wanted to get a sense of the rhythms of war and why there were so many civilians being killed and why the U.S. was dropping such a huge amount of bombs in that area of Afghanistan in particular. And so we went in and embedded with the 173rd Airborne Battle Company. And we were very lucky because the commanders really believed in transparency, and they believed in having journalists there. And they let us very freely embed with the troops and live with them. And we spent 2 months. I left for a period and went back. But we spent 2 months, more or less, with these guys living on the side of a mountain in bunkers and going on patrols every single day and seeing a lot of combat. And at the end of the mission, the whole thing was sort of gearing up. It was a battalion-wide mission called Operation Rock Avalanche. And it was really an operation to go out and go into some of the most hostile areas within that region, look for the Taliban, look for insurgents, and bring them out so that the troops could attack them. And in fact, we were airlifted onto the side of a mountain. We jumped out of Black Hawks and basically walked for 6 days with everything on our backs. Mm-hmm. There were pallets of water and food that were airdropped down to us. But we were ambushed by the Taliban on the sixth day, and three troops were shot, and Sergeant Rugel was killed. And it was very intense, and the whole scene was depicted in an incredible article written by Elizabeth Rubin in the New York Times Magazine, but also in a documentary called Restrepo that was done by Sebastian Younger and the late Tim Hetherington.
Yeah, and one of the things I noticed from your photographs was, you know, for all the photographs we've seen of Afghanistan and Iraq, this photography reminds me of a previous generation, and the photography you saw in Vietnam that you didn't really see as much in these last wars. I don't know if it's because of restrictions against photographers and cameramen in these war zones, but really some amazing photography.
Well, thank you. And yeah, definitely. I think the rules of embedding, or at least I can only speak from my experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq, but it's definitely, the rules are definitely more stringent. I mean, we have to offer a pretty sanitized version of war because we have to sign all sorts of waivers when we embed with the military saying, if a soldier is killed next to you, you have to get permission from the next of kin. If X happens, you have to notify this. And so we don't have to show our photographs, but certainly we have to sign documents saying that, you know, we will get permission from the family if someone dies, if their face is visible, if there are any recognizable marks on that person or that person's body. And so that did not happen in Vietnam. It was a very different situation, obviously, in Vietnam. The photographers or journalists who were out there filed whatever they shot. And so it was a much more brutal look at war.
Yeah. The name of the book is It's What I Do. Lindsay Addario, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pulitzer Prize winning photojournalist Lindsay Addario speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her work appears regularly in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. Her book is titled It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Published by Penguin Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.